How you doing, man? I invite you to co-host here. Probably going to start this thing in a couple minutes. Just wait on a couple people to trickle in. Yo, good to see you here, man. Thanks for joining today. I'm going to wait a couple minutes and then send out invites and stuff to some people. And I'll just be speaking from this one today. I'll probably join with my other account, but it's just annoying to have to manage two.
100%, I get it. Yeah, I'll go ahead and send this invite out to people too.
Sweet. All right, cool. I'm just going to retweet this one, and then we'll get after it. How you doing today, Eric?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, fam?
Pretty good, man. Just another day. Just working, you know. It's kicking off my day. Where are you based, by the way?
I'm in Alabama now.
Okay, cool, man.
Got a new
friend. Nice. You say that with a tone. There's a lot behind that.
Oh no, Alabama, it's great-ish, you know. I'm from Cali, and I'm not adjusting well.
Holy shit, man! Yeah, I can imagine. That's quite the difference.
Yeah, but wow, it's a better place to raise kids. I think they have good schools.
100%. Yeah, I mean, you can throw a rock or a dart in a map, and it'll. It'll be a better place to raise kids than California.
That's pretty much what we did.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh, cool, man.
I'm in Colombia right now. I'm from Philadelphia area, and spent a lot of time in California and San Diego for the last few years. So right now I'm just traveling in a place that I can put my head down and get a lot of work done. So that's more or less the rationale for being in Colombia at the moment. But things are good out here. Gorgeous weather and good coffee, good food, beautiful women. It's hard to complain.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, dude, I'm really glad we get to talk today. I've been meaning to reach out to you for a while and do some kind of collab. I think I first came across you on a podcast that was on Spotify. My friend Matt Aaron, who I'm not sure if you know, recommended that I listen to you, and I did, and I was just really appreciating your unorthodox takes. This was about a year ago, and I was like, oh, cool, another independent thinker that actually understands tokenomics. So, just a pleasure to be here with you today, and I'm looking forward to discussing like tokenomics from your perspective, you know, what it is, what you're seeing, and particularly in the Cosmos ecosystem, where I think you're most, paying the most attention, and fielding some audience questions. So if anyone has questions, feel free to post those underneath the space here in the comments. We'll answer those by the end of the podcast, the end of this Twitter space. And yeah, without further ado, Eric, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Yeah, thanks, dude. So yeah, I'm Eric. I do a lot of tokenomics consulting. I was the last like 9 months or so, the tokenomics lead for Phi Labs, core contributor to the Archway protocol. Most prominently known as the founder or co-founder of AstroVault, which is the primary AMM on Archway. But really just approaching DEXs from a different perspective. Just curious, I was wondering which podcast you came across me on.
You know, I couldn't even tell you. I'd have to look it up, but it was one that was posted on Spotify, and I looked for more, and at the time it was the only one. But I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm pretty sure it was a Cosmos specific podcast. This was probably when this had been sometime last winter, so call it like January, February, 2023.
Oh, gotcha. Or it's probably, yeah, I forgot the name of that one, but Cosmos Voices or something like that. But yeah, I studied economic philosophy in college, which I don't know. I got bored from chemical engineering and just switched over. And it was fun. I enjoyed it. But what are you going to do with, you know, economic philosophy, right? I just had a free education, so I figured I'd get a degree in something. Went into the casino industry, where I dealt cards for a long time. I got into card counting, got banned everywhere. I found some issues in some games that they launched, so I redid the math on them, got into game auditing and game creation, and really just did a bunch of stuff in casinos. And just wanted a new side hustle on the side because I couldn't card count anymore, and switched over to crypto and just got to do a lot of cool economic philosophy stuff over here.
That is wild. I can imagine that game auditing kind of background, that must have given you such an edge and really molded your mind to think about tokenomics and maybe the security of these systems as well.
Yeah, it's a lot of similarities, a lot of carryover, and just tracking the numbers. It's just, yeah. One thing just about the difference between economics and economic philosophy, since we are finally seeing more people get into tokenomics, but usually from the economic space, is that economics is really good at like using math to like make efficient the systems that are in place, and economic philosophy questions and is better at creating the systems from the first perspective, because the math is only really good at like optimizing if you already have set direction, but they don't always have set direction. And so that's the primary difference. And like game auditing is like, you already know the goal. It's all just based on house edge, hands per minute, like stuff like that. And without understanding the goal, just a lot of things are pursuing nothing. It's just weird.
That's such an important point. I'm really glad you brought that up. I think I see that in the difference between the token engineering space and then the broader tokenomics space. There's a lot of people, and particularly mechanism design. I think people in that categorize themselves more in the mechanism design space understand the goals of whatever it is they're building. And then the people in the token engineering community, and this is a generalization, but they're very focused on the math. And I like to say they miss the dark forest for the Merkle trees. They're really focused on the particulars and optimizing for certain things. They're not as focused on why they're optimizing for the thing they're optimizing for. So that's really cool that you've got that background in economic philosophy that's helping you think in that way. I think it's a very underappreciated skill.
Well, thank you, brother. It's nice to see it appreciated by you and a couple people who find me on podcasts here and there.
Yeah, hopefully there's going to be more. That's something I've been talking to a handful of token economics people about, is amplifying this narrative for the next market cycle. I think people really don't understand tokenomics or why it's important. So maybe this is a good place to launch in to the few prepared questions that I have. The first is, what is tokenomics or token economics? Can you define that and explain maybe a little bit about it?
Yeah, so most people think of tokenomics as just like, oh, supply and who's getting how much and when does it unvest, and like that is so boring. Like that's the like the just base level, I guess, that people ask for. What real tokenomics is how the token makes the ecosystem work. It's the flow of the token through the user's perspective, how it interacts with the ecosystem, in every way, shape, or form. So it's much more to do with the overall interactions, whether they start from the user, whether they happen behind the scenes, just any of that interactivity. For example, like with Archway, like most of what I'm doing, it had very little to do with like where the token's going. It's much more to do with like how, as demand for block size for block space is increasing, like what happens to like to affect the token and gas prices, stuff like that. It's much less to do of like, oh, well, this group has 10%. Like, that doesn't matter. What matters is like if there is a business, what the business is, what they're actually selling, and how the success of selling whatever they are selling contributes to the utility and demand for the token.
Love it. Yeah, it's like, you know, I heard a couple of things that I'll maybe paraphrase a bit and throw it back to you. But like the business model, it's essentially like a business model for a protocol. And you mentioned it's how the token flows through the ecosystem or through a protocol. and you know, causes participants to change their behavior, and maybe also how it causes the token to accrue value, I think is another component. But yeah, with you on, like, it's funny how people think that tokenomics is all about artificial scarcity. I think I've been thinking about this lately. Tell me what you think from a philosophy angle, but I think this has come from Bitcoin, and people are looking at Bitcoin as the gold standard, so to speak, of tokenomics, because it's the thing that's on top of the leaderboards right now. They're saying, well, Bitcoin is valuable because it's scarce, so we should just make our token scarce, and then it'll be valuable.
Yeah, I mean, in general, Bitcoin doesn't really have great tokenomics, so it's rough seeing that compared to, like, I've seen so many projects like, oh, we have a halving or a thirdening every 2 years. Like, why? But fundamentally, what tokenomics gives us the opportunity to do is make the stock market a way that makes sense. Like right now, if you think of businesses, most businesses, like when they go public, they have a stock. And as the business succeeds, theoretically, the value then goes to the stock. But usually it is just theoretically. Like the stock is like potentially able to get so much of it, and then you could take over a company and get the real world assets. But that's so impractical, because usually even the float would never be enough to get controlling interest in the company. But with tokenomics, you don't have to just like, oh, we had a new raise, we just printed and minted a bunch of tokens. Then you start thinking of stocks and tokens. You can control it. You can use tokens to pay members the same way you use stock to pay members with stock options. But by tying it integrally into the business, you can definitively have this tokens or would-be stock gain value from the success of the business in a way that is still only speculative or theoretical in traditional business at this point. So realistically, that is the future. That is what tokenomics creates, and that is what's so valuable about it.
Interesting. That's a really cool take, and I'm glad that you're sharing some novel takes, because I haven't heard exactly this stated before, but it sounds like you're saying this is like a new primitive for a financial system that's going to allow it to actually make sense and actually, you know, tie the value that's being created and captured to the, tie the value that's being created to the value that's being captured, rather than having everything rely on speculation.
Yeah. And it flows so much more dynamically. If you think of like Uber, that like, or any of these tech businesses where they have to operate at a loss for so long in order to hopefully eventually have a profitable business. Like, if instead of having a stock, and like if they're spending so many billions of dollars per year or whatnot, if they had a token, they could operate at a loss with this token if these investors are willing to provide liquidity against that token. They keep earning the token. They're holding the price of the token up. That token's being printed and given mostly to the team. The team's able to sell it to get enough working capital to keep operating at a loss. But then they can still exit the position whenever they want to. If they're like, you know what, I'm going to stop putting up with this, like they're operating at a loss for so long, they can just remove liquidity. They're not held to these loans indefinitely. Like, it's a much more liquid stance, but anybody can come in and be an investor and be willing to offer up their capital in a way that's fully dynamic. It's just so much easier and so much less red tape.
Interesting. Yeah, it's like, you know, enshrines the right to exit in a way that makes sense. I think that's one of the unique value propositions of crypto, is that people don't have to participate in it. They're not forced in. And that gives rise to a host of other properties, or maybe stems from a host of other properties. I think what you're describing, I would broadly categorize as programmable money. And this is something that, you know, I think this, I see three unique value propositions for crypto that are like significant, maybe four. But the first one is censorship resistance, right? There's nothing else that can really do that. The second one is programmable money, which gives rise to what we call mechanism design, which is what I'd like to talk about in a sec. And the third is maybe like open finance, where you have this public auditability of the funds or the operations of some protocols, so that everybody can see that a certain thing happened or that the system works in a certain way. Might be another like 2 or 3x value proposition, but not necessarily a 10x. But this mechanism design, this programmable money, I think underlies a lot of what you do at Archway and with AstroVault. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the high level of that, about how you think about mechanism design and what you think the opportunities are and what you're seeing and how you think about that broadly.
So, agree with your takes on just kind of what's cool about it, programmable money, all that kind of stuff. But what I think about it from mechanism design is what it takes to make a business succeed. The easiest way to incentivize a business to succeed is to give money, like buy one, get one free type thing. Like, oh, wow, okay, I get a better deal here. I save money. And we can do that far more directly in crypto than we can in other spaces. So, what I want to do when I'm looking at what should be a business, I'm only willing to work with a company if it is going to be a business, if they actually have something to sell, is I'm going to incentivize whatever leads towards sales, whatever's going to make you money. I will give ownership of the protocol through this programmable money to incentivize what's going to make us money in a way that magnifies the money that's being made. So, I teach some master's courses on this in University of Nicosia, and I go through like a five-step process of like figuring out what the end goal is, then itemizing like the best way to reach that end goal. Step three is aligning incentives, which is kind of what I'm talking about, where it's now in everybody's incentive for this to function as a well-greased, well-oiled wheel of a business model. But then what I've seen overlooked so many times is this fourth step is to go through and break it in every single way possible. And so what I'm doing as a tokenomics guy is one, figuring out how to like what to incentivize, what is going to then drive the most sales. And then two, figuring out how anybody could break our model, how they could tap into incentives in ways that don't benefit us, how they can break our wheel, how they could break the protocol. I mean, so many people are focused on code audits, but a lot of the issues, especially in DeFi, is that code's doing what it's supposed to do, and what it's supposed to do doesn't fully make sense. Things like Terra Luna, like they were going to crash regardless. And it's not like they've passed seven audits. That's great. The code all worked. What it was designed to do didn't make sense. And so it's approaching things from that perspective. And then step five is just you keep re-going through two through four until you get a model that's unbreakable. And at that point, it's a system that can be made more efficient through traditional economics.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that point about how the code in a lot of systems it does exactly what it's supposed to. And Terra was so unique because when I did a post-mortem on that, I found eight things that went wrong. If any one of those had not been in place, then the system might have been able to perpetuate itself a little longer, not indefinitely. But there was no code exploit in Terra. There was nothing wrong with the code itself, which is incredible. It was a huge, complex system, but all of the issues with Terra were economic issues rather than technical issues. So this has given rise to what I call, what a lot of people are calling economic security. And it's distinct from technical security in that technical security is a lack of bugs in the code. Economic security is a lack of bugs in the incentives. And it's extremely important if you have a system like Terra that's using some kind of economic security mechanism where there's a price dependency, or maybe there's an oracle that's giving you data or different things that are being economically secured by financial incentives to have an economic security assessment. And it sounds like that's some of what you do when you're designing these protocols.
Yeah, very, very much so. And not only qualifying what is like potentially insecure, but then also fully quantifying it. Part of what I did with Archway when I went in is like their whole goal was to build a layer one similar to Ethereum with better tech, something from the Cosmos stack, where then they could incentivize developers perpetually through the gas basically that they attract to the platform. So whoever's driving transactions and computation to the L1 platform are then getting remuneration through not only part of the gas fees, but also part of inflation, so that they're incentivizing people to come build here. The issue is if you could then do that and just use your own transactions forever, then you still get all the money back and you could DDoS the network for free. That was the case when I came in. And what we had to do is like figure out, no, we have to set it up so that it can't be DDoSed for free. Like that's inherently not safe. But then also quantify, like under any new model, how expensive is it to DDoS and for how much time? And so I had to set up some pretty complicated simulations based on block size, based on times and whatnot to see, like, okay, it's going to cost this much money. At this point, we can't break, but we can bend. And I try to set everything up so, like, we understand what it takes to bend. Don't break, but bend. But make any user who's not using the protocol the way you want them to have to pay you a bunch of money to bend it, basically. It's like, oh, with Astro Vault, we have our stable pools where say like they're constant sum market makers, which should throw a lot of red flags. It's curve without the curve. But in order to fully unbalance the pool, the fees go higher and higher. You're still getting the one-to-one swaps, but those fees are owned by the protocol. So you can unbalance it to a point where it's temporarily unusable in one direction, but you have to pay us a ton of money to do that, and then it still balances pretty quickly over time. So the worst you can do is slow us down, and if you want to pay us a bunch of money to slow us down for a while, go for it.
That's awesome. I really like that use of a mechanism to accrue more value to yourself while keeping the network secure, and I'll have to dig into that a little more. It sounds like part of your economic security assessments are going through with simulations. Is that the main way that you find these exploits, or is it, do you have an iterative approach, or is it more like a gut feel kind of thing where you'll be like, something's fishy here, and then you sniff it out?
Actually, kind of similar to a pen tester in a code audits. I look for any potential exploits at basically any intersection of parts. So any part in itself, but then also any intersection of parts, like, this contract meets this other contract. Like, what if this contract is used in a way that this contract doesn't expect, but from the economic perspective? So simulations I use specifically to quantify it. And if I'm curious, I'm like, this might not work in one direct, like, as I think, like I build, everyone does sims. Most people do them in Python. I literally just do them in Google Sheets, and I do like really minuscule versions of them, because it doesn't, like, you can test it to the extreme with pretty simple parameters usually. But I make modularly testable simulations so that you can just take this and then input any type of sim into that framework and basically just stress test it. Like, what if it's way lower than we expect? What if it's way higher than we expect? What if the price does this or this? I'll use the sims to confirm what I believe already might be a risk, and then to kind of quantify, like, okay, this is, like, it might be tough, but this isn't going to break the protocol, and just make sure I have the numbers to showcase, like, what does happen in that case. That helps.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that approach. I think good enough is good enough. And so I'm also a fan of Google Sheets models, particularly with financial models. And I think a lot of people go overboard on the code side because they like code. I'm not one of those people, but we do have those people in-house at Token Dynamics. But I'm with you that is like my favorite approach to economic security as well. And something I'll have to share with you is our economic security assessment process. We just recently have started to formalize an iterative approach. So I think we can quantify and evaluate all possible economic security problems in a protocol with this approach, but I'm still trying to define it a little better to make sure that's the case. But that's really cool that you're so rigorous about this. And it seems like it's certainly helped with Archway. I came across Archway maybe a little before I found that podcast that I saw you on. And Archway is incredible. I mean, do you, Archway, I think, was the first protocol to have contract secured revenue, or was there one before it? Because I know Canto formalized this.
Yeah, so Archway, as far as I know at least, was the first to really, really think about it. I mean, I think Near is probably the first to do it in some way, shape, or form, but Archway was the first to, like, focus and iterate on it and develop it a lot further. Canto actually took that verbiage. They took the verbiage from the pitch deck. So a lot of the investors of Canto and the people behind it had been pitched by the Archway team. They took it, they did it really fast, and they took the entire narrative and spun with it. So good on them. That's also super shitty, but yeah, so now people think of Canto with contract secured revenue, and all the people at Archway were pissed. But so happens when you take a long time to build. So Archway has done it a lot better, like, fundamentally, with not only the gas rebates, but also doing it from inflation properly, as well as then if you look at, like, Canto and really most layer ones, they either don't protect from DDoS, they don't have things that accrue value to the layer one directly. One of my frustrations and one of the reasons I was excited to build on a layer one is there's this idea that, like, oh, cool, the token's valuable for gas. Like, okay, how valuable is it for gas? How much of the token do you actually need? If you can do a million contract iterations with one of the token and the token's 10 cents, is like, I never need to buy more. So, like, why does it retain value? And then if you're using a layer one for rented security, how secure do you feel building on them if you don't trust that they're going to be able to maintain value enough to sustain the team? Because then it's not actually secure because they don't really earn from the rent that you're theoretically paying. So it's, I don't know. I do believe in efficiency and specialization. We have built Astro Vault out as an application instead of an app chain itself. And so it's important for us, for whatever layer ones we're deployed on, to be secure themselves. So we want to make sure that the security that's being paid for is actually being paid for.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm with you. There is a bunch of things that you said there that I resonated with. The first one was, it's what happens when you take a long time to build. People take your stuff, but Kanto is what happens when you don't take a long time to build. And it was pretty obvious to me when Kanto was being shilled by all these VCs that it was a cash grab. So I'm glad that that seemed to have faded into obscurity. There were a lot of people shilling Kanto too. It was like Ryan Sean Adams was shilling Kanto. Like there were some big names that were, clearly heavily invested in this protocol that blatantly ripped off Archway. But great to see that Archway has been doing so well. And you mentioned Astro Vault. So maybe we could talk about that before we talk about Cosmos and Atom on the topic of accruing value and having security in the network.
Yeah, Astro Vault's our baby. Ethan and I, Ethan was in the space a little bit ago, but Benji and Fabio are on the team as well. They're here. We've been building that for well over a year before we'd even heard of Archway, before we decided to build it on Archway just as an application. And fundamentally, it's an alternative take on how AMMs function. Because going back to first principles, doing my philosophy thing, it's like AMMs are so focused now on concentrated liquidity because they finally realize like, oh, well, real yield is what we can extract in fees divided by liquidity. So if we can't raise the numerator, lower the denominator, but they still haven't quite understood all that. And fundamentally, the beginning of AMMs, at least for the most part, is like Uniswap, five guys trying to put Coinbase on chain because they were invigorated by Nakamoto's white paper. And they did it. In order to do it, they had to take the revenue that Coinbase was earning and give it to liquidity providers, so that there would be liquidity enough to trade through. They pulled it off. It worked. They patted themselves on the back, celebrated a little bit, and then sat down and been like, wait a minute, we just gave all the revenue that Coinbase was earning to liquidity providers. We have it on chain. How do we make revenue? You know what? Let's launch a token. And that is everything that has been copied over and over and over again from, from AMMs. Oh, crap. We made a business that doesn't make us any money. Let's launch a token. And then we have to start giving out the token to try to make the business work. But it's not a business if you don't actually make any money from it, because the token has no revenue. And so we built out Astro Vault separately as a way of getting revenue for the token so that the token itself is actually valuable and not fundamentally worth zero. So that when we give out incentives to bring in liquidity, the incentives actually mean something, and that we earn from the liquidity and the trading fees so that there's actually a way to profit from running this business.
That's brilliant. And this must have been one of the things that I initially resonated with. I think, I'm vaguely recalling maybe you talked about Uniswap or something like that, or AMMs generally. I think Uniswap is like my arch nemesis for tokenomics because it gives so many people the false impression that you can just create something and capture value later by printing a shitcoin. And Uniswap has not only failed to capture value through three upgrades, which in my opinion is like unforgivable, because they clearly know the problem now is that they don't have a fundamentally valuable token. They're setting an example for everyone else in the industry that you can do this. So we have all these other people creating peer governance tokens that are fundamentally worthless. And the precedent they set made it so that no competitor, no other AMM can capture value to their token, because Uniswap set the bar at zero. If you have a business competing, getting zero profit, its competitors are also not going to be able to profit. So every AMM since Uniswap has had to capture even less value by giving away an inflationary shitcoin to subsidize liquidity. So this is a systemic problem caused by one protocol's failure to capture value up front. So I really appreciate that you're in Astro Vault doing the opposite of this and actually accruing some protocol revenue to yourselves with these novel mechanisms, and the opportunities there because Uniswap didn't catch on in Cosmos. And I assume, and I'm not that familiar, but I assume that most of the other AMMs are not, in a zero-sum competitive environment like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wild that that's been, but I mean, it's not even just AMMs. Most things in crypto, they're not businesses, they're projects, and they expect or even need to have a 9+ figure valuation to function. It's like it's not worth that. Like, what's it even worth? What revenue does it have? It's like, oh, well, we can turn on a switch and generate a little bit of revenue. Like, how much can you extract from users realistically? It's frustrating, man.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if Uniswap had captured all of the value that they've facilitated in swaps, they would still not be worth as much as their current market price. They've facilitated a couple $1 trillion in swaps, and there's whatever 100 million tokens or billion tokens. And if you do that math, it's not enough to justify the amount of value that they've created.
Yeah. So what's kind of cool about like Archway is they were trying to approach this same problem from the other side of like Ethereum's captured a ton of value from Uniswap. And I haven't looked at it in like the last 2, 3 months, but at one point, like $23.1 million of Ethereum was burned in 1 month from the usage of Uniswap alone. And it's like, what if like Uniswap got half of that? Then the Union token would get something. But instead, Ethereum got $23.1 million worth of buy and burn pressure. And the Uniswap token got literally nothing. And so from their layer one perspective, they're trying to set up so that like builders can actually earn from the value that's being driven to the L1. But from our perspective, it's like Uniswap could just be earning ETH from the ETH that's on its platform. Like it's an inflationary token. And so when we do go to EVM, because we will at some point, Astrobot will just be earning ETH directly from the liquidity hosted on the chain, in addition to earning the trade fees. And then instead of giving the trade fees to the liquidity providers, we'll give our token to the liquidity providers. The trade fees all go to buy back and burn our token, giving that inherent value. But like we haven't even launched our token yet, and we already have over $23,000 of protocol earned liquidity, which we think will be a really big buzzword for the next bull market. Instead of just relying on kind of cronyistic bonds, we've already accrued several $1,000 worth to buy back and burn our token. We've already accrued over $1,000 worth of like Archway based developer rewards, and we haven't launched our token yet. We haven't provided any incentives yet.
That's awesome. And I really like the, for lack of a better word, the flywheel. I hate that word, but sort of the chain of economic incentives or the chain of economic tokenomic mechanisms that you use to pass value through to various stakeholders in the system. It's like rather than paying out the liquidity providers directly, you're giving them your token, which itself is accruing value from the use of the system. And I think too many people, when they're designing protocols, forget to chain the value across stakeholders and through these different tokenomic mechanisms, through sort of like I envision a plumbing system or like a steam engine with pipes going from place to place that are passing the value on and generating this, fundamentally price action. Because when you have a fundamentally valuable token, there is some arbitrageable value there that people will get by buying the token and then using it for whatever the token gets, whether that's rewards from using the AstroVault AMM where that are accrued to this token and they're getting, a 5% or 10% or 15% yield, or whether it's the use of a currency as a medium of exchange that causes it to accrue value. There are different ways that tokens can be used, which give them what I call price floors. And these are the minimum possible price for a token to sustain based on its use in the protocol. And so I think you've done that at AstroVault really well and are lining up to do that really well with a token. So that's encouraging to see. Any final thoughts on that? Or do you want to launch into maybe what the tokenomics of Atom are and what that's looking like? I've seen in passing some debates around the value of the Atom token in Cosmos.
Yeah, oof. I'm ready for it. Why not?
I figured this might be a spicy one, but I'm admittedly not an expert in this. So I'm relying on you to maybe share all sides of this debate. Because what I will preface this with is Ethereum has this as well. I'm not an ETH maxi. I have a dot ETH, but it's mostly an identifier. And then Bitcoin certainly has this problem. So maybe to preface this is not a problem unique to Cosmos or Atom, of like the token not having as much fundamental value as is needed to provide security. But this is a problem in Bitcoin right now. This is potentially a problem in Ethereum with L2s and is being compounded by Eigenlayer with restaking. Maybe with that background, that this is, hopefully this lets you off the hook to some Adam Max season here.
Yeah. I'm not one to talk about like velocity super often, but if you look at like Ethereum, at some times it's burning so much through the demand for the token that it's net deflationary. When it is net deflationary, that tells me it's undervalued. That literally the value of the tokens should be fundamentally going up because it's being used so much that it's burning more than is being minted. That cannot happen endlessly. Therefore, like the overall value should be at a point where its inflation is low, but not zero. Just like even comparing like if it's being burned even to what's being minted, the inflation of the US dollar being like what, like 8-9%. So it should be going up at that rate. Atom does not have any use for its token other than the liquidity that it has access to. Like fundamentally, there is no real use for the Atom token other than gas payments of less than 1 cent. And even then, now you can use it for gas on Neutron, but you still can't use it for gas on pretty much everything else in the Atom ecosystem. They all have their own gas tokens. And its inflation still at like 20%. I was doing the math at one point. I haven't looked at it in forever, but it's like Ethereum is minting like $4 billion worth of ETH per year, but it's also like spending and burning like $4 billion worth of ETH per year, something near there. And meanwhile, Atom was printing like $700 million worth of ETH worth of Atom per year and spending none of it. That's wild. And I didn't really get into this earlier in this call, but philosophically, the purpose of monetaristic inflation, the reason you print more tokens, the reason you print more dollars or anything else, is to decentralize perpetual expenditure. So I want to print more tokens so that I could give some to the team, so that I could perpetually incentivize the team to build. I want to give some more tokens, maybe to give to stakers if I'm in a layer one platform, because I think that it's valuable to get security. But you have to view that printing of tokens as an expense. I know we're, at least in the United States, we use a CPI to measure inflation, which is literally just the change in the price of the dollar. But monetaristic inflation is like how much is actually being printed. And fundamentally, that is an expense. And they're not even incentivizing security by giving it to stakers because they're not doing it in a way that makes it more secure. If they were, they wouldn't have to print so much. So they have to basically figure out a way to have supply sinks or to drive value to the token and figure out a way to minimize the expenses of how much is being printed and where it's going. And fundamentally, it's not looking great because as soon as you do that, people are like, oh, my rewards are lower. I'm going to sell because they built themselves up on a bubble.
Yeah, it's challenging. People think, I think far too often people are thinking from the supply side of the equation rather than the demand side. So they're saying, well, how do we use this token, these newly inflated coins, to do stuff rather than thinking about what would people want to do with these newly inflated tokens? And then you end up with excess inflation, inflation, supply and excess of demand, essentially. And that sounds like a tricky problem for Atom. I know Ethereum had EIP 1559, this buyback and burn mechanism that is causing ETH to increase in value roughly proportional to the use of the Ethereum chain. It's not a perfect mechanism, but it's at least something that is better than having a gas token with an infinite velocity. For everyone listening, by the way, velocity is the rate at which a currency changes hands. So this is an economics concept, and the velocity of the US dollar is around 5.5. So on average, each dollar changes hands 5.5 times a year. Ethereum's is maybe something between 25 and 50, and it could theoretically be infinite, which is a trend that probably applies to most gas tokens. And it's kind of the underlying cause for concern here. But Eric, that sounds like a lot of potential issues can arise from this. Maybe you could explore a couple of those. What are the problems for Cosmos if Atom continues to decrease in value?
I mean, it's being used to pay the core teams that are developing it. And if you look aside from the tokenomics at just what the core value proposition is of Atom and what the business has looked like objectively, they built brilliant software. possibly the best in all of Web3 as far as like what they offer for the security of a blockchain or like Tendermint Consensus. Absolutely brilliant. They built out brilliant software and they give it away for free. Like at least the Polkadot ecosystem was able to charge rent in some way, shape or form for a while, but Cosmos doesn't. You can go spin off a Cosmos SDK chain like DYDX is doing, and zero value goes to Atom. Zero value goes to the teams that developed Atom. They built a brilliant software, a brilliant product, and they give it away for free. And now we're just trying to hope that it maintains being worth billions of dollars when there's zero on the revenue side. If the price of Atom goes to zero, the development teams who are largely being paid in Atom will stop building because they're no longer being paid anything that's going to pay their bills. And so they'll go, they'll be picked up by other projects, they'll do other things, and the core Cosmos SDK will no longer maintain being built out by those teams. Now, theoretically, if any of the applications like DYDX, like Archway, are still doing well, because they aren't necessarily dependent on Atom token to do well, they may continue the work, and they may keep building out the Cosmos SDK, because it is open source. And we've already seen a fork where now like a different team is maintaining it than the original one. But yeah, they are basically viewed as a community good or a public good, but we know from just basic economics that like in a laissez-faire ecosystem, everybody wants public goods to be paid for, but nobody wants to be the ones to pay for them. And since nothing's mandated, then they fundamentally don't get paid. Nobody drives value to Atom directly, and nobody's really incentivized to.
That's such an important point that I think people miss about tokenomics is like it's frustrating, and I'm sure you share this, that this entire space is founded on making money, and yet there's such a strong reluctance to making money. And what I mean is in the first sense of the word, to create good money, and in the second sense of the word, to capture some of that value and earn some of that money yourself. And people forget that these developers are creating applications and blockchains that are subversive and a lot of cases unwanted by the existing financial system. And they're expected to compete without paying themselves or without earning money for this, what is essentially a business, to sustain itself ongoing. And the logical result of that, the end result, is a tragedy of the commons, exactly like you just described, which is where you have a bunch of people that really want something to be provided by the market, but none of them individually have enough incentive to pay for it. They're all expecting someone else will pay for it. So in let me point out, the Bitcoin Cash ecosystem was one I was a part of for quite a while. They had one dev team that was shouldering the burden of the entire protocol innovation and maintaining the nodes and everything like that. And so they, you know, they didn't have very much going on because these developers weren't funded. And then they put out a proposal for 10% of the Coinbase reward to go to their dev team or anyone's dev team who was voted in by the miners. And people didn't want that. So now Bitcoin Cash is a even more of a clusterfuck than it was. And nobody's providing for development ongoing. So if you are thinking about what the future of development looks like in an ecosystem where devs aren't funded because there is no value capture, the token is not valuable, look at Bitcoin Cash and see, you know, kind of where that's gone. I think that's a good example of what lays ahead for those protocols that don't capture any value. And this can be for L1s, this can be for app chains, this could be for decentralized applications, protocols like Uniswap. Uniswap right now is sort of an exception because the VCs are keeping it afloat. There are these massive bags that A16Z and others have that they are not wanting to dump because they would nuke the entire order book and you know, kill the golden goose that's you know, the goose that's laying, well, mostly rotten eggs for now. But I have to come up with a way to workshop that analogy. But I think the first thing that you pointed out is the lack of value capture. And I wanted to talk about maybe what that would mean. You know, what would it mean for the Atoms, for Cosmos' economic security if, you know, if the Atom token went to zero or significantly dropped in one day?
Yeah, so what would happen to Ethereum if Bitcoin went to zero?
Or if the Ethereum went to zero?
Well, if Bitcoin went to zero, what would happen to Ethereum?
Okay, well, I'll answer this. I was asking, I might have said if Bitcoin. I meant to say what would happen to Cosmos if Atom went to zero. But
you definitely asked that right. What I'm trying to argue is that it is the same thing as what will happen to Ethereum if Bitcoin goes to zero. Like, Ethereum is independent of Cosmos. Ethereum has demand aside from Cosmos. Applications on Ethereum outside of Bitcoin, applications on Ethereum will still work great if Bitcoin goes to zero. The issue is all of the liquidity of Ethereum, like, or at least a lot of it, is tied to Bitcoin. And so you have this level of liquidity leveraging. If Bitcoin goes to zero, so many of those pairs are against Ethereum that liquidity will drive it down with it. And you can arbitrage against the USD pairs, and they're getting further and further USD-based pairings, but the arbitrage will still take it down a good 80%, if not more. Same thing happens. What if the dollar goes to zero? Like, sure, Bitcoin goes up compared to dollars, but so much of the Bitcoin's liquidity is tied to the dollar, like, it's still worth less purchasing power than it was before. Unless like massive trading happens and it is able to decouple from its dollar-based pairings. But wherever there's liquidity leverage, you're tied to it in some way, shape, or form. Right now, the entire Cosmos ecosystem is built up with Atom as the primary on and off ramps and the Atom market makers as the primary liquidity offboarding. If you think of like a project on Cosmos, like say Jackal Protocol, Jackal has like two core pairings, one against Osmo on Osmosis and one against Archway on Astro Vault. If Atom goes to zero, Osmosis's primary liquidity for the Osmo token is against Atom. That drives Osmo near zero. Archway's primary liquidity is against Atom in some way, shape, or form. That drives the price of Arch down. If Jackal wants to sell for dollars, they have to sell for Osmo, which sells for Atom, which sells for cash. Or sell for Arch, which sells for Atom, which sells for cash. So if there are any rugs upstream, it hurts everything downstream. But if you cut out the foundational layer, which I argue is dollars and then Bitcoin and then Atom, then everything on top of this kind of house of cards falls down with it.
Interesting. Okay, so you're thinking about the chain of liquidity that's in the ecosystem that will affect Atom's value over time. How do you think about like the ability to profitably reorg or attack? And I'm admittedly only superficially familiar with Tendermint consensus, but what would happen if the TVL on Cosmos eclipsed the cost of protecting the chain, or like the capital investment required to protect Cosmos chains? And is that a realistic possibility? Because I'll give an example. Bitcoin SV doesn't have a lot of bridgeable value. You know, there's not a lot that you could profitably double spend through a reorg, but because there are just not that many L2 assets. But this is the problem with proof of work chains, is that you can profitably reorg them if they have significant TVL. So let's say there were $1 billion worth of Tether on Bitcoin SV or Bitcoin Cash. If you could send those Tether to, you know, some exchange, whether it's centralized or decentralized, trade it into Bitcoin or Monero and exit that ecosystem, then go back and I guess you would need a DEX, and then go back and reorg Bitcoin SV or Bitcoin Cash, wherever those secondary assets, those L2 assets, or not L2 assets, but secondary assets originated from, and then spend them again, then you would have successfully double spent the chain and profited in the process. Is there any analog scenario in Cosmos that happens if Atom loses a lot of its value and continues to bleed?
So that's never happened yet, but additionally, with it being focused on like a bunch of different chains in the ecosystem, you could only really attack one chain at a time. The highest chain by TVL is Osmosis at like 77 million, over 30 of which is in their own token. But even then, I'm not super worried about in Cosmos. One, because they have such a high bonded rate. But two, because it would need to be based on liquidity, not based on valuation. And with the liquidity leveraging I was just speaking about, even if there's like, say, a valuation of $500 million on a chain, how much liquidity you could actually extract from that would not be $500 million. And like, what if Elon Musk sold? Oh, he's worth $200 billion. Like, okay, if he sold all his Tesla stock, he'd get what, like 12, 14 billion out of it? He just collapsed the company. Like, he doesn't actually have access to that much money. And so with all of these different tokens that has a value of $500 million, since all of them would still get liquidated to Atom directly, and there's only so much liquidity against the Atom token, a full-on attack and spend of like $500 million might net you like $12 to $14 million and collapse the Atom token. So I don't think that it can realistically be done profitably. And even though the Nakamoto coefficient on some of these chains is pretty low, like I think it's like 7 on Atom, it's very difficult to pull off, and still would have to be on isolated chains.
That makes sense. Yeah, because everything's paired against Atom. So like the exit liquidity is Atom. And also there is the, you know, underlying your point is the marks to market fallacy, which is the idea that assets are worth in aggregate whatever their last traded price is times the circulating or the existing supply of those assets, which is a silly premise. It's something that's used in traditional finance that absolutely breaks the assumptions, the security assumptions of DeFi. And I hope that that fallacy will die in the next couple of years, but I'm not entirely sure what is going to take its place. Maybe we could riff on that a little bit. You mentioned Nakamoto coefficient, which is maybe something else to come back to. But how do you think, have you seen the trend of oracle-less protocols? And how do you think this the market cap fallacy is going to play out in crypto?
I think that all the stable coins are going to crash. Like all the ones that are basically collateralized by value instead of collateralized by liquidity. I mean, that's fundamentally what was wrong with Terra Luna. People look back and they're like, oh no, like the issue was they printed their own collateral. It's like, no, the issue is they acted like they had $24 billion worth of collateral with $20 billion worth of debts. So they're like, see, we're over collateralized. But if they sold all of that collateral being Luna, they only had access to how much liquidity was against the Luna token, which you're looking at like $50 million, which is a decent amount of liquidity. But now if you're comparing the $20 billion worth of debts to $50 million of collateral in a way that would definitively tank the price and showcase that it would then be under-collateralized, as soon as you access like 1% of the 5% over-collateralization, you see, oh crap, it's not actually collateralized. And DAI is following the same model. And all of these forks that are following, oh, we're using DAI's model, like this is great. It's like, okay, if you sold all of that Ethereum collateral, you're going to lower the price of Ethereum. And you start doing this in other illiquid assets, you're like, oh, well, we've got this diverse basket of assets, but they're still all leveraged against Atom or something like that. Then if any of them are sold, they all get devalued significantly. And it's actually under-collateralized because it's based on the liquidity against it, not the valuation. So we're going to see a lot of DeFi protocols that are not actually safe, that people think are safe, capitulate because they're still using the market cap fallacy.
Wow. Yeah, I'm with you. I think... Some people have called these exogenously collateralized stablecoins, just meaning that they're using an asset outside of themselves to collateralize their own stablecoin. And you put it perfectly. It's like if someone starts to sell those assets, the remainder of the assets that are collateralizing that stablecoin start to drop. And if that causes a panic, then you have a death spiral, just like Terra Luna. I'm curious. If there are any assets like this that are significant in the Cosmos ecosystem that you're seeing, and then maybe we can talk about briefly about economic security, Nakamoto coefficient, and then we have a couple of speakers. If anyone else would like to ask a question, we'll bring people up on stage and start accepting speakers in a couple minutes.
In Cosmos, none of them are significant at this point. A couple of them are trying, but like fundamentally, what we're trying to do is get actually collateralized assets so we can do DeFi properly because the value of it is fantastic. But what we see with these exogenously collateralized assets and stablecoin specifically is the goal being that you can print dollars with your randomly inflated tokens instead of selling the tokens. And as soon as you get to the point where you think you can print dollars instead of selling, you're screwed. We just had an issue with Osmosis, the chain I mentioned with the highest TVL in Cosmos. Their developers, like three of their core developers, they put up $2 million worth of the Osmo token for collateral for loans, and they cash out those loans, and they just went on a nice vacation, did whatever with them. And then the price started dipping, and so it got to the point where they were liquidating a $2 million worth of assets on the community's face. It's like, be responsible and DCA out. You can't print this money. We almost had that same issue with Curve. Like it's fundamentally dangerous if you think you can just print dollars instead of selling. You have to sell the assets.
Yeah, and there has to be exit liquidity for you to sell. So it's, you know, it goes back to this problem of marking to market assets. That's just like the problem, you know, very similar to the problem we saw with Curve being added as collateral on Aave. The founder had like half of the circulating supply and posted those in order to get loans in some more liquid assets. So I forget what he borrowed, maybe ETH or some stable coin or something. And then he took out a mortgage on a huge house. And so he's using these illiquid assets that are marked to market as being worth a lot more than they actually are. It's kind of ironic because Curve it partly solves this problem by allowing founders of protocols to bribe the LPs with often, you know, adequately valued lump sum of tokens. I won't get into that, but I see we have, you know, 20 or so people in here. If anyone has a question, feel free to raise your hand or request to speak. Want to ask Eric any audience questions that we have, and then maybe we'll just wrap it up after that. Wait a couple seconds to see anybody raising their hand here.
Hopefully some people hop up. Yeah. One more thoughts on this is, like, as I mentioned,
yeah,
collateralization needs to be judged based on liquidity available, not not just the valuation of the assets. That's still not going to be safe. So that would be drastically, like, unfathomably safer than what we have right now. And that's still gameable because the owner of Curve can put up a bunch of liquidity and then take out the loan in those assets and then pull the liquidity and sell. So because, like, you can still be the liquidity that you're basing the valuation on, it's still not going to be safe. And we've seen this kind of stuff happen in real world assets. We've seen this stuff happen with stock, and it does end up in collapse and business failure, and it ends up in things like foreclosures and bankruptcies. The issue is the real world has systems to deal with this, of just printing more money and dealing with it. And we can't do that in DeFi.
Right. Or we can, but there are significant externalities to doing so. I think this is why I'm so interested in the trend of oracle-less protocols. There were a couple. There was one recently that was launched, Ajna or something like that, Finance. And it turns out they had like 11 high-risk exploits that were found, high-risk vulnerabilities that were found in an audit. But they were supposed to be one of the first big oracle-less protocols. So they, I think they referenced their own internal oracle. There's another protocol called Hoyu. It's Hoyu, Hoyu underscore IO. And they are an AMM aggregated with DEX. And, an AMM aggregated with a lending market that allows people to borrow against assets whose prices are based on the internal oracle. So it works really well for long tail assets, might not work for assets that have, you know, that can be arbitraged across AMMs. But this is a trend that is sort of seeking to solve this mark to market problem. So very, very interesting take there. I see we have another speaker just came up on stage. BN Yusuf, feel free to ask a question to Eric here.
Jim, Eric, Jim, thank you all. Jim talking. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay, yeah. So I just want to actually hopped in late, so about I was not able to catch up the whole thing. But I would just like to know when is it daily? You guys hold this premise, because I actually enjoyed what I had. Now I would like to actually open more in your spaces to get more knowledge from the technologies you're sharing. It's actually nice hearing from you. So I don't know if it's something, is it a weekly thing, the EMA, or is it something that you do daily? So if I can hop in. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. This is for us. This is a weekly event. We have guests like Eric every week or so. For Eric, this is, I don't know, Eric, what are your upcoming events that you're speaking at, or, you know, upcoming spaces that you're hosting? Maybe you could share some of those.
I'm speaking at NFT Nashville, November 4th. I hop in spaces every now and then as a guest. Archway or Acerol will have them decently often. Always open to, but I'm not hosting any regularly myself.
Okay, I think I'll just follow you guys so that in case I receive any notification from any space I could learn from. Thank you very much. I actually knew about Nate since I've been following him, and then I just saw Eric and I'll follow Eric and talking so that I could get more knowledge. Thank you. It's nice hearing from you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the great feedback. Really appreciate that. Everybody, please follow Eric. And if you're interested in more tokenomics, I think he's going to be posting about those. He's going to be posting certainly about AstroVault as they move into their token launch at some point in the future. Not going to ask when token, but you know that for all of these kinds of things. And if you're interested in tokenomics broadly, feel free to follow us. You can follow me. I'm official ESC, also up on stage here, Nate. And I think that's it as far as questions. Eric, where can people find more of your work and what would you like to share?
On the Archway site, or specifically, go check out AstroVault. Please go check out our stats page. Our $23,000 worth of protocol earned liquidity. We'll be launching our airdrop pretty soon in our token. Pretty soon here, so we can kick off the incentives. But we'll be getting more listings and adding more products and features to it. There's quite a suite of cool stuff.
Go farm the token, guys. Use AstroVault. Awesome. All right. Thanks so much, Eric, for joining today. Really appreciate it. And this is a great discussion. I wish we had more time, and we'll have to do this again.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Nate.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks everyone for joining.
Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Motherfuckers walking around here looking faceless, trying to make a living selling friendship bracelets. Dead ends dragging out the max amount of payments. Red down days got them acting all bankless. Yo fam, what? Check these tokenomics. They probing this bear, flexing broken honest. I had to lay my soul down, I'm just roasting otters. And then to end a long day, 11 bowls of chronic. Never known the politic, I was born to frolic. It's been my policy to pollinate all over the plot. We got a lot of apologists jumping in at the top. We like to measure their velocity before they hit rock bottom. Over impossible loss, it's all moss, and I'm liking the odds. Fondue in the morning, forming mycological bonds. Flick the cap, yo, the road is highly involved. Flip a coin, diary fall. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Trying to figure out the max amount of DNA stacked in non-toxic, just to get a better place. Smacking on the hostage like the shit is play for keeps. Clowns, white knight, and all these Maybellines. They call it implausible when model after model keeps on ripping off the code and going full throttle. Eats, tearing apart your community. All these low-hanging fruits bearing zero liquidity. Got a planet in reach, coming standard to each. I'm on the back 10, stargazing after the siege. Commanding all the management to grab a few Z's, and then we'll round up the beasts and send a messenger east. Y'all better sign a release when I'm bumping these beats. Hands up if I got motherfuckers drumming the streets. Yo, we got a few dubs, we got a couple defeats, and if you're coming for the king, you better have some of each. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served.
Spaces.